In today's episode of We'll Work for Purpose, I'm joined by Ronald Potts, who is a former pagan and atheist who turned Christian. Together we talk about his story, some of the trials he faced, and some of just the unique life experiences that he had to deal with both growing up and in his adult life. So without further ado, here is the 16th installment of We'll Work for Purpose, and I hope you get something out of this one. To today's episode of Will Work for Purpose. Today I'm joined by Ronald Potts, and he's a recent convert to Christianity. He's an amateur theologian, teacher, and philosopher. And today we're going to kind of talk about developing true beliefs and sort of the journey that he went on to become a Christian. Ron, how are you doing?
Doing pretty good. How are you doing?
Excellent. Glad to have you on today. So you recently became a Christian, and I guess where were you before your Christianity?
Immediately preceding being a Christian, I was actually a pagan.
Okay.
A Norse pagan specifically.
Okay. And what is like paganism, like for people who don't know, like what would like a Norse pagan do?
Modern paganism is a reconstructions of old beliefs or ancient beliefs, generally based on a specific ethnic or regional identity. And it's taking the myths and reconstructing a spiritual belief off of them. The practicing pagan doesn't always accept that they're modern reconstructions. That's what they are. There's no direct lineage to, European paganism, at least.
How did you fall in with Norse paganism? Like that's something that most people either would never have heard of or, you know, would, you know, not be exposed to, generally speaking.
Well, my life was always a journey, I guess. I never was a Christian or a believer in Christianity. Of course, I grew up around it vaguely. We went to church off and on until I was about 11 or so, but we never consistently went or read the Bible or prayed or anything like that. So I was an atheist and agnostic, and I kind of came to a point where I felt certain that there was more to life than just material, that there was more to humanity than just the material presence of a person. And I felt like there was a spirituality, but it was I purposely rejected Christianity for a long time. I thought I knew something about it, but later on, it turns out I didn't know much. I had a friend who was a Wiccan or a practicing witch, and she did that for 25 so years. I was talking with her a lot. And so I did a general kind of vague pagan European paganism. And then I was just kind of drawn more towards the Norse paganism. A lot of that had to do with the Norse mythology and a warrior ethos. I was drawn to spirituality in general because I was convinced that there was more to the human experience than material. I was probably not a great practicer necessarily, but I did do the runes, and I made runes and I read runes and I studied all that. I didn't do any magic, I had some spiritual experiences with it.
And were you drawn to it because of the aesthetic, like you like the look of the Norse sort of gods and like that, you know, like the Celts and things like that? Were you just kind of drawn to it in that sense, or was it just kind of like, oh, this is different than Christianity, this is sort of different than anything I've really heard of, it's kind of cool, I'm just gonna kind of, you know, go through the rites and rituals and things like that?
Is a little bit of both, but I also felt like there was a deeper truth within that I was accessing or I was participating in. There is an aesthetic appeal to it. That's probably more like why I would say Norse pagan instead of just general pagan. I felt like there was genuine spiritual experiences involved in it. I was generally drew to it. I'm not entirely sure exactly why, but I also felt like there was a spiritual truth that I was experiencing in studying about it and contemplating or meditating on participating in the runes and the reading of the runes and stuff.
And were you doing this like sort of just by yourself, or did you have like a group of people that were into the same thing? Like you had the one Wiccan friend, but did you have like all these, you know, did you have like a community around it? Were there a lot of these like Norse pagans in your area, or were you kind of just going it alone?
No, I was by myself as far as, particularly as far as like settling in the Norse paganism. Like I had my friend who was a witch, is what she proclaimed herself to be. And then my wife, she was kind of into the witch too, along that lines. But I was more into the Norse paganism, and the main difference was an aesthetic appeal, really.
I see, yeah.
The warrior ethos that you get in the common ideal of Norse paganism now, as people conceive it, and you got the warrior ethos and the protector and the seven noble virtues and all that stuff. Mm.
Yeah. So, sorry for asking so many questions about that. I've never met someone who fell in with Norse sort of pagan beliefs or anything like that. Most of the time, it's something like people develop sort of like an affinity for like astrology, or they have, you know, this like general pluralistic spirituality. But it's so rare for me to find people who are who have been in these other sorts of religions. I know my dad was into the occult like long before I was even born and things like that for, you know, like 10 years or something like that. But he's disabled now, so I wouldn't even be able to talk to him about it. But it's just one of those things that I find interesting, because it's one of those alternatives that, you know, most people don't know much about, I'd say, generally speaking. You know, if you go up to an average guy on the street, he's not going to know, you know, that you could even practice Norse pagan, you know, beliefs or rituals or anything like that.
Yeah. Now, like I said, I was probably not the best practitioner, so to speak. I guess an analog would be kind of like a nominal Catholic.
You know? Oh, I see. Yeah. Yeah.
As far as attending any sort of attending to most rituals, I was more of a isolated. And the only real ritual I took place in was the runes.
As far as the pagan systems of belief go, you know, there's very little that I know about them, except as insofar as they've been compared to Christianity. You know, a lot of them have like corn king gods, or the, you know, dying and rising gods, and gods that have been strung up on trees and things like that, you know. But insofar as they differ than Christianity, it's our, you know, I haven't looked too much into them, because for me it was one of those things, like when I became a Christian, it was like I was looking at all the you know, everything that bared some sort of resemblance to Christianity. I was looking at, you know, sort of peripherally, just to kind of like, because people use those other faiths or other similar or comparable systems of belief to sort of discredit Christianity or something like that, you know.
Whenever I was growing up, like as far as Christianity was concerned, I didn't have as much experience with it as I perceived in my mind. But I also had some of the experience of seeing people that I like to call, or I used to, sometimes it still applies, is a hypocristian, you know, a hypocrite Christian.
Right.
Well, you know, I'm from a small town, so people, you know, most everyone. You get people who go to church on Sunday and then they're all praying and being humble and stuff. And then they leave church Sunday morning and they go to the local, you know, diner, and they treat the wait staff like crap. They don't tip, and they're all and they're the worst customers. That's a common trope that almost every server knows, like the worst customers are Sunday mornings after church crowd. Unfortunately. And then the people who would go to church and then they were alcoholics outside of church, you know, but they would act like they were Christians, or they would want to say that they're these Christian, strong pillars of Christian community. And some of those I didn't judge fairly, to be perfectly honest. And so I kind of got into, and also I'm in my like late teens, early 20s. So I'm naturally rebellious to a degree.
Right.
And I joined the military right after high school. Well, at that point, I would be what I would call a militant atheist, or even a new atheist, because this is at the end of the 90s or beginning of the 2000s when new atheism really kind of kicks off. And so I'm at like a militant anti-Christian, really, of course. That's what a lot of that stuff amounts to, is being anti-Christian around here, you know, in the West. It's all framed. So much of the West is actually framed in within or around Christianity. That's another topic I'll bring up. But I was drawn to the dark stuff, you know, that I was like a militant atheist, and I wanted to provoke religious people, you know, I wanted to be provocative and stuff and shock. And I found something that I wrote back then, and it was actually really embarrassing. And this was around that time, about 20 years ago. And what I wrote was exactly like what you would hear from the most basic internet new atheist type and about the existence of God. And it was kind of weird reading it. It's but I was at that time, I was like that, you know, I was a lot of it was rebellion against social norms. A lot of it was just a general rebellion, not knowing, ignorance, and not having good representation, because particularly for me, like I said, I'm from a small town, so technology always comes later. And so by the time I went in the military, we didn't really have internet. I didn't even have a computer in my house because we weren't particularly rich either. But when I went in the military, I actually went in the military to work on computers. And that was my first exposure to computers and the internet. It was actually going to the military because I left my small town and went boot camp in California. And then I got to Quantico, Virginia to do my computer training. As a culture shock.
Yeah, I can imagine. You know, computers have been around. I started using, well, it wasn't like computers they are now, but the first computer I used had 250 megabytes of RAM. So it was like, you know, that's not a lot of RAM, you know, and then like the hard drive itself was only like 500. It was like 10 gigs or something like that. You know, it was like very, very small, small time computer, you know, and it's like, it's weird to think back to a time when like, when you didn't have this, you know, now my cell phone has more, processing power, more storage, more everything than that first computer I used, you know? So yeah, I can only imagine going from, you know, not using technology at all to then, you know, big city where, you know, everything is everywhere, you know, lots of technologies everywhere. And so I guess at this point you're in the military, you're militant atheist, you're going through basic and things like that. Were there any people in your life that you like to get shock out of, sort of religious people? Whenever I was an atheist, I was more, soft in that sense. Like I was very, because I was very, very introverted. Like, I'm not sure that I really spoke much until I was about 20, 21, you know? And for a lot of the same reasons, actually, because my dad was an alcoholic as well. And so like, there's just kind of like that juxtaposition of being like very quiet. Like, you don't want to, you know, you don't want to, cause they're so unpredictable. You don't want to sort of do anything to provoke them or whatever, you know. So like, you make yourself like a blank slate. It's actually like, and this is actually what happens to a lot of people who are children of alcoholics, is they develop what's called a flat affect. And so their face won't reflect emotion. Their voice, like my voice, typically is very, very flat, very monotone. There's not a lot of pitch in it. And that's actually like a defense mechanism, basically, is that you develop to deal with unpredictable people. And so it's like you get it conditioned into you over time to be able to sort of basically become a stone, you know. So were there any people in your life that you liked to, like, was there some Christian kid that you always picked on, or some Christian guy that you would always get in fights, arguments with, or, you know, things like that? Like, was there someone always that you liked to get a rise out of, or did your militant atheism kind of like push him away?
Well, at that point, it was more like an online persona for the most part. The thing that you just mentioned about my brothers and my mom and my dad are alcoholics. The interesting thing about that is I didn't grow up with that because before I was born, because I'm the youngest, my dad had a lot of problems with alcoholism and being abusive in stories that I've heard. And my dad is a very interesting person, flawed, but great in many ways. Mm-hmm. But he had, you know, some abusiveness when he was drunk. And it got to a point a little while before I was born. I'm not sure exactly, but I was born in 78. My middle brother was 73 and oldest brother was 70. Somewhere between 73 and 78, my dad quit drinking completely. He just he understood it was a problem and he had to quit. And he just quit. And what was really cool about that actually was there's a lot of people, most everyone else that I was around my dad were drinkers, and my dad had quit drinking altogether. So I didn't grow up with my dad drinking. It wasn't until my late teens that he decided to start drinking again. I guess he felt like it was okay again because he didn't have to raise, he was basically done raising his kids. As far as that goes. But it was actually kind of cool because we would go to like gatherings, like what we call a fish fry, like a party where you fry a bunch of fish. And it would be in the middle of summer, and my dad would have his thermos of coffee, hot coffee, and that's what he would drink. Everyone else was drinking alcohol or beer and stuff and getting wild, but he was actually very reserved and drinking coffee. That was like he drank coffee no matter what time of year it was. So in that regard, it was cool, but you know, towards my late teens is whenever they all started drinking again, or my mom and dad did. But there was a lot of problems that we all had that I understood was because we had suppressed feelings that were coming out sideways. And that was something I observed from them and something I desperately wanted to control within myself. I didn't want to be the person that was would never access their feelings. And then because I think, in my opinion, and I've not found anything to suggest otherwise, but you know, Jesus says that whatever's in the heart will come out. I feel like the worst thing you can do is try and suppress your feelings, because at some point it's going to come out sideways, I call it. It won't be productive. It'll be destructive. It'll come out sideways.
I mean, and you're, I think you're dead on there, because a lot of people think that you can repress your feelings. Like, let's say, and they study this between therapy and clients. So like if a client has an aversion to their client, so let's say the therapist has a bad history with people who are overweight. This is an example in one of, these, learning tools that was developed by this therapist named Irv Yalom. He's an existential psychotherapist. And he basically, this is one of his examples. He said, you know, he himself was overweight, and so he had negative feelings towards people who were overweight. A client comes in, she's overweight, and he knows that he has these negative feelings towards her, but he takes her on as in part also a therapeutic tool for him, so that he knows that he can work through these negative feelings. And the whole time he thinks, you know, I'm not expressing any, you know, I'm being very professional, I'm being very polite, like nothing is, you know, I'm not letting my negative feelings take over here. And then you get to the end of the story, and this is a smaller story of a bigger book, but you get to the end of this in particular story, and turns out he, you know, he does this end of session review with her, or the end of like your, like they saw each other for like 6 months or something like that. And at the end of the clinical, her time with him, he asked the question, did you ever experience any negative feelings from me towards you or something like that? And she goes, oh, you know, of course, especially at the beginning, it felt like you hated me. You didn't want to look at me. You didn't want to touch me. You didn't want to, you wanted, it seemed like you didn't want anything to do with me. You wore disgust on your face plainly. You know, it was like one of those things where it's exactly like what you're talking about. He tried to repress those emotions and they came out sideways. They came out in a way that he didn't intend them to, you know. But they came out nevertheless, you know. So yeah, I mean, I agree with you there.
Well, and I got to see this up close and personal with my family, because especially it was towards my latter teenage years, probably, I think it was probably 15 or so, when my dad and mom started drinking again. They would drink, and then my brothers were drinking, and there would be people come over drinking and stuff. And I would see a lot of this stuff come out while they were drinking it. And I felt like I understood it wasn't actually the alcohol. It was things that the alcohol was bringing out, because alcohol is an disinhibitor, you know. And so these were things that they had in them that the alcohol was allowing to bust out, and it was busting out sideways, like, you know. And I observed this because I've always been the introvert who was observing everyone. I wasn't really part of the group, any group. I would be the sort of wallflower who was observing everything. And so I got the existential ideal or metaphysical existential question stuck in my head early. And I won't say that I was a great therapist for myself, but I did pursue self-control and self-awareness and was consumed by that pursuit.
So you were an atheist for a while. You were in the military. You sort of dropped the militant act and you just kind of became a normal everyday atheist, just sort of rejecting belief in God, not kind of really worrying too much about, you know, whether there was a true religion or true faith or, you know, if there was anything else to what's going on in the world. But then you kind of started to get nagged by that idea that, like, maybe there's a bit more to an individual than, you know, the material that makes them up. Maybe there's more than the gray matter in their skull and the you know, the veins under their skin. And so you started to ask yourself that question, I guess. Did you start to read any books, or did you start to, did you go ask someone that question? Do you say, well, you know, I have this, I've been thinking about this. What do you think? Like, were there any people in your life or in your like community, or did you go to, you know, how did you sort of pursue answers to that question?
Well, a lot of that was internet community type stuff, chat rooms and stuff like that. And I was interested in psychology to a degree informally. I don't have actually any formal education in pretty much anything. That's why, that's one of the reasons why my bio says amateur. But it was really just a philosophical conversation between, I've got one friend that we've been friends since like eighth grade in high school. So that's well over 20 years now. We would always talk about this stuff, and he grew up in a more directly Christian household to a degree. His mom was religious, but his dad wasn't. But his mom read the Bible a lot and prayed, and his dad didn't really. But there was no real conflict in that. But we would always talk about this stuff, and I would study history. I studied a lot of history. I always was fascinated by history. And certainly one of the things I learned in my studies of history was that people are the same the whole world round throughout all of time. That there is a common humanity. There is a common way of being is that human. And so with my study of history, you really kind of get if you study history well, I think, you get a grasp of what humanity is. You got to understand the villain in this story could have been me. I'm not just a good guy in this. Right.
Right.
And you see humanity in its basics, you know?
Yeah. That, you know, that's a really good point because a lot of people always read, what do they say? The victors read are the victors, write history or something like that, you know? And so a lot of people read it as if, you know, one, they read it as if the victor is always the good guy. And two, they always read it as if the victor isn't the good guy, the person reading it thinks that they would be the victim. You know, they don't ever think that they would be the perpetrator, you know, or the person doing the evil, you know, and I always say, like I say exactly what you say, it's important to read history with the idea that you could have been the Nazi, you could have been the blue cap in the Soviet Union, you could have been, you know, a soldier in Genghis Khan's army, you could have been any, you know, you could have been one of those people, you know, like it's very probable, in fact, since most people, given the opportunity, you know, and provided there weren't any other barriers keeping them from doing it, partook in great evil, great and heinous evil, you know?
But in my love of history is something that I always pursued, even that I have had that like my whole life. And that's what my buddy and I, we love history a lot, especially military history. And, we actually got to where we bought some, replica sword, real deal replica swords, and we did a little bit of getting into that.
That's cool.
and you know handling them and seeing how they would handle and studying of the reconstruction of Renaissance martial arts and sword fighting and all that.
That's cool. That's something that I'd always been in, like, just as an aside, I guess, like blacksmithing and things like that. I think that that's like a really cool thing. It's just like one of those things that just seems like, man, the first guy who did that must have been like, you know, the first guy to pull out a metal sword in a fight where the guys had sticks, you know, I can't even imagine what that would have been like, you know?
Yeah. But the blacksmithing is something I'm greatly interested in. I keep saying I'm going to get into it, but I haven't yet. But I love that. I love history. You see a lot of problems. Nowadays, you see a lot of present, what you would probably call presentism. You know, it's like, oh, well, those people back then were just ignorant, or they didn't know anything. And it's like, you know, they didn't know a lot of the discoveries that we have now necessarily, but they weren't just ignorant and they weren't just stupid. You know?
Yeah. Presentism is a good word for that, actually. Have you ever read C.S. Lewis at all?
Yeah. Well, I mostly listen to C.S. Lewis.
I listen to a lot of C.S. Lewis as well. He actually, if you go on Audible, they have his book called The Four Loves, and that's actually read by C.S. Lewis. I don't know if so you can hear his voice and things like that, which was cool for me to hear because I'm a big C.S. Lewis, just big fan. But he calls it chronological snobbery.
Yeah.
But presentism is a good one, as that's more like succinct, I think.
Yeah, I mean, I've been listening to a lot of C.S. Lewis lately. I finally listened to the whole set of the Chronicle of Narnias. I did audio for that. And I'm mostly through with God in the Dock, which is pretty fascinating.
Mm-hmm.
I haven't really learned a whole lot of new stuff from Lewis in God in the Dock.
Right.
But he's articulated things very well.
Mm-hmm.
And it seems like, to me anyways, not to put myself on Lewis's level, but it seems like him and I think very similarly and have had a very similar set of observations throughout our lives. But, you know, I've always loved history. And Lewis, of course, he was a literary critic of medieval.
Right. Yeah.
I guess. Yeah. Medieval literature or whatnot.
Mm-hmm.
I think even my paganism, I think that had to do with my interest in history.
Mm-hmm.
A lot of my history, I would always lean more towards European history and military history. But I tried to study most history in general, and I think that was helpful for me because I guess what actually happened was I kind of adopted, in lieu of an official religion, I adopted the U.S. Constitution and its ideals as my ideal set.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, the ideals set forth by the U.S. Constitution and then the Declaration of Independence is a universal humanist ideal.
Right.
And so I was kind of a humanist is what I would have been as far philosophically, I suppose. And, you can arrive to that studying history. You see how people are similar in history. You can see how there's not one boogeyman, you know?
Right, right.
And if you study history, you know, not to get too far down there, rabbit hole, but every society ever to exist has engaged in slavery.
Yeah.
You know, but
yeah,
you see.
Yeah, and I think, Lewis kind of has this sort of like aside, I think, in his Mere Christianity when he talks about the question of good and evil, essentially, where, you know, at all times and all places, by all cultures and all people, there was some sort of moral imperative. And many times it's often the same, like honor. That's a value that's held in every culture, no matter where you go around the world. Honor, you know, now the outworking or where the way that honor looks is different sometimes, you know, like I had one professor that said, one culture honors their grandmother by bringing her cookies and another honors her by eating her when she's dead, you know? And so it's like one of those things where it's like, if you ask what they were doing in that culture at that time, they'd say, we're honoring our elders, you know? And so it's one of those things. It's like, it's one of, you know, but yeah, continue on your, down your path here.
But we'll kind of come up, get off the chronology a little bit.
Okay.
That kind of brings up a good point, is one of the, to me personally, one of the more compelling arguments. I came through the Jordan Peterson route.
Mm-hmm.
His biblical lectures had a huge impact on me. Well, see, you know, fast forward to being an adult, and my friend that I said was a pagan for 25 years, Miss D, we'll call her.
Okay.
But I kind of got in contact with her after my first divorce. And that marriage was doomed from the beginning, because what that kind of ended up being was, there was a group of friends, and let's see, that was 2007. So I was getting in my late 20s, and we had a group of friends. Like, the whole group kind of grew up into adulthood, got married and went on their separate ways. And then us two, my ex-wife and I, we were kind of left out of that group. And so we're like, let's get married.
I see. Yeah. But,
I mean, it wasn't exactly that. I mean, I think there was some genuine affection. Mm-hmm. It developed out of, let's say, desperation. And it's like, well, we got no one left. It's just us two. But we ended up getting divorced. And that was a pretty big crisis for me, because one idea I always had in my mind was a sanctity of marriage sort of thing. It's like, if I'm going to get married, I'll get married once. I'm not going to get a divorce. We're going to work it out. And so I had in my idealism that marriage was a one-time thing. And whenever we end up just having to get a divorce, things just didn't work. I got into a lot of depression, a great deal of depression, because actually just before our divorce, I had lost my dad. And the thing, my dad and I had a pretty good relationship. We weren't close emotionally, but we had a very good intellectual relationship. We liked to talk about the deepest possible things we could come up with, you know, about metaphysical and the existential questions. And he was a really smart dude. I'm fairly smart, but he was smarter than me. But he had to have had an eidetic memory. He remembered everything he ever read. My dad was always the rock for me. He was kind of, he's sort of like a god to me. He was my hero. He was always my hero. And I always thought he was invincible and that he would never die. And if I always needed anything, I knew that he would be there. You know, it was like one time I needed $200 to make it back when I was in the military. I came home on leave and I needed $200 to make it back. I was just busted. But he didn't ask me any questions. He's like, you need $200? Here's $200. You know, that was actually an important moment for me. But
yeah,
he was that rock for me. And I always kind of thought, you know, I had it in my head that he would just always be there, that he would always live, that he would never die. And he ended up dying in an accident. And so that was kind of beginning of the spiral for me, because he was my foundation. Because I knew no matter where I went or what I did, if I ended up busted, I could always go back to him. He would be there. He would always have my back. And so that happened. And then my marriage fell apart. And so I got super depressed, because in my ideals, I had failed at what I thought would be like the two top things. It was family and love.
Yeah.
I felt like I had completely failed as a human being in the two most important things, is how I felt about it. So I was super depressed. But at this time, I guess through Facebook, Miss D and I kind of found each other. We grew up sort of together in high school and stuff. So we kind of knew each other. We just started being friends. Mm-hmm. And then there was another high school friend that was living in, this is a town 40 miles away. It's a bigger town, but that's where I was living then. That was after the military and all that, of course. And, we had another friend from high school who had a birthday party, and we attended that, and my now wife attended that as well. That was, mm-hmm. that would have been the first time I've seen her in 15 years or something like that.
Wow.
And what's interesting about that too is she was my high school crush that I could never quite get over.
Yeah, yeah.
And also the high school crush being the crushing introvert that I was, mm-hmm. that I never did ask out.
Yeah, yeah.
But she ended up being there. Her and I end up like off in the corner just talking and drinking. What ended up happening is between Miss D, my current wife, and I, we end up having these spiritual experiences that were interpreted through paganism. And so that's how I start becoming a pagan, is I'm having these, what I feel or understand to be, not just feel, but I understand to be legitimate spiritual experiences that seem to be playing out in real time. And that's how we all kind of, Miss D was always a pagan, but so more or less. But my wife and I, that's how we kind of get into paganism, is we start having these shared spiritual experiences.
Okay. And then, so I guess what was the moment that like flipped it all around and, you know, you like the, I guess the moment that like triggered your Christianity, like was it another spiritual event, or was it, you know, something else, that kind of triggered it?
Well, my wife and I, when we got married, she already had four kids. So I went from single with no kids to four stepchildren, like in a snap of a finger.
Yeah.
Her ex-husband, there was a lot of problems there, right? So I had this crazy idea in my head that I was going to ride in on a white horse with my and save everyone from the abusive problems that they had experienced and stuff. It actually ended up being a very bad idea. But what that did do is that led me into a deeper study of psychology and pursuit in that. And that's how I found Jordan Peterson.
Okay.
Was when I was looking into psychology and stuff. And then Jordan Peterson did his biblical series. And then that got me to thinking, well, you know, I never actually did take the Bible serious for myself. I never did read it seriously for myself. I just always kind of assumed it was fairy tale mythology or whatever.
Right.
And so I was through Peterson, I decided I should seriously read the Bible for myself. And when I did that, I tried to take, you know, you can only do so much, but I tried to take every presupposition or bias that I had. I tried to take all those and set them aside and throw them out as much as I could. And I didn't have a religious tradition with which to bring to the Bible. So my goal was to let the Bible speak for itself whenever I did that. So I started doing that, and I found Jonathan Pageau and his symbolism work. And found that really fascinating. But one of the things is I started to question, well, okay, so I'm a humanist, right? I'm a universal humanist. Why? You know?
Yeah.
That's I started a good wondering question. What's the foundation of that? And I was like, I started asking myself the moral question, and I couldn't answer it. I couldn't answer the moral question for myself. And I was like, well, that's not good.
Right. Yeah.
That was one of the things I started pursuing, was trying to find an answer to the moral question. And concurrently, I was reading the Bible serious, taking it serious, letting it trying to let it speak for itself. And then I find Jonathan Pageau and his symbolism of the Bible. And I start studying, as you know, sometimes people take this wrong. They want to act like I'm saying I'm some sort of expert or something, but right. I started looking at multiple areas like science and history and philosophy. And I was, as best as I could, I was trying to test the truth of Christianity, and I was assessing the truth of it. Ironically, like the atheist helped me in that regard, because of the whole thing of the Bible's been disproven. There, you know, God is disproved and all that stuff concerning religion or Christianity. And it's like, well, has it? And then I looked at science, you know, and the thing is, God isn't a question that science answers. It's not even a proper question for science.
Yeah, I've always heard it. It's they're essentially like non-overlapping magisteria. So it's like they're separate areas. You know, it's like you don't you don't use math to bake a cake in some sense, you know, like, or you don't use, the examples could go on. You don't use chemistry to build a table or whatever, you know, like it, you just use the wrong tool for the wrong job, like much like a carpenter might, you know, you don't use a hammer to saw a board in half, you know, like you have to use the right tool for the right job. So yeah, I agree with you there.
One of the great points that Jordan Peterson made about the Bible, and this was one of the first tests of the Bible that I used, was Jordan Peterson talked about how much the Bible speaks about truth. I did a reference study, you know, I was like all the passages that spoke about truth or being truthful. Mm-hmm. And it was like all throughout the Bible. I mean, it was like clearly a very important part of what the Bible was talking about. If you just do like a word search kind of thing for truth in the Bible, it's all over the place. And about being truthful. One thing I did find fascinating is, well, I'm reading the Bible and I'm doing these other studies. So and I'm re-examining history, really, is what I'm doing, is I've got a grasp of especially like European history or Western mm-hmm. culture history mm-hmm. and development. So I'm kind of re-examining it. I'm thinking, let me get some new eyes and look at this again. And I come, as far as history goes, I kind of come to the same conclusion as Tom Holland does. Mm-hmm. In his book Dominion, it's like
I just started reading that book today, but continue.
Is you can't escape in the Western culture, you can't escape the effects of Christianity and the, mm-hmm. the shaping effect of Christianity. You just can't do it. And one thing I find reading the Bible is the answer to that moral question that I was struggling with is I realized where the foundation of those morals that I already believed in. My humanism, I realized that my humanism came from the Bible as I'm reading it. Mm. So I find this foundation, you know, I could have assumed that since I didn't know the foundation of my humanism, my own humanist beliefs, that they were false, but I didn't. I decided to see why would I believe in those values. And I did see those in the Bible whenever I examined the Bible fairly as I was reading it. Mm-hmm. Historically, I found that you couldn't, that our culture that is we've received is completely shaped by Christianity. The values, the moral values, the ethical values, the society values is completely, it's not, I'm not saying that that Christianity created all of it, but every bit of it has come to us through Christianity. What we have received has come to us through its interaction with Christianity or its being a Christianity as a prism, like Roman and Greek philosophy are Roman and Greek philosophy, but they've come to us through its, through an interaction and a rubbing against and contention with Christianity.
Okay. So going down these questions and re-examining the history and re-examining your pre-existing beliefs and sort of, just kind of coming at it with a fresh view eventually kind of brought you into the Christian fold. Initially, well, I guess two questions come to mind. You have a wife and kids. Did they at all follow suit or were you kind of just on this journey alone?
Initially, I was on the journey alone because I said whenever I came into this existing family, I decided I was going to come in and be the savior and mm-hmm. set everything right. And especially when I started looking at psychology, I was going to figure this thing out. I was going to fix everyone and fix everything. It's all going to be ideal. But what I've found was that ultimate challenge that I had before me is I had these people that I was responsible for. And not only was I responsible for these four children and a wife, these people needed healing. So I took on that responsibility, kind of white knight in it, so to speak. But
right.
So I take on this responsibility, and that's another thing with Jordan Peterson is I realized the more of that responsibility that I took on, the more meaning I had in my life. Because whenever we got together and we got married, I was completely shiftless. You know, I had mm-hmm. that divorce and my dad had died and there was no meaning to my life.
Right.
What was interesting about that time frame is I didn't realize it at the time, but I actually helped myself through that time with a form of cognitive behavioral training. See, you know, I started reworking my own thoughts.
Yeah. You know, I noticed that a lot throughout your story. You know, you talk about like examining yourself and sort of like being aware of yourself, and like a lot, especially early on when you were a kid, like being self-controlled and things like that. And like one of the central tenets of CBT, cognitive behavioral therapy, is essentially notice your thoughts and notice your actions, you know, like, and simply noticing those things actually is shown to improve and improve your mental life and your physical life drastically. Like a lot of dieting coaches, like 90% of the work there is write down what you eat every day. And that's like, basically, once you start doing that, once you start noticing what you eat, what you put in your body every day, your consumption of like, you'll drop your calorie consumption, because you'll be like, "Whoa, wait, okay, I already had 4 donuts today. I don't need 6, you know, that kind of thing." And so it's like, yeah, I mean, most people don't realize, but you know, and especially like given the pandemic situation right now, but they're becoming their own therapists. And that's essentially what I heard a lot throughout your story, was that you, in some instances, became your own therapist. You know, you kind of did the things that a therapist would do for you, but you did them yourself, you know?
Yeah. Particularly in that time, I got into it. I've had one time in my life that I actually had a brief glimpse of considering suicide, but for the most part, I'm not wired that way. I'm not wired towards self-destruction. You know, before I was a Christian, my motto was born to lose, live to win. You know, it was kind of fatalistic, but still right. Hopeful.
Right.
But, see what was interesting about that though, is I didn't even realize it was anything like CBT until afterwards, when I started looking into psychology. But I kind of did this reworking of my own thoughts through CBT, just being aware of them and examining them and saying, well, is that true? Is that objectively true?
Yeah.
I mean, I know I feel that way, but is that actually true? Is that what's actually happening?
Right.
And, one of the reasons I thought I could white knight my wife and these kids was because I had been successful with myself, and I actually had turned around and been successful with Miss D. Actually, I helped her in a lot of ways to rework her thinking and rework her way through depression. And, you know, I didn't think I was some therapist or anything. I just helped her. I challenged her thoughts and helped her to examine her own thoughts. But I had an amount of success with that. I didn't fix her or anything, but there was some success there. So I kind of got in this idea that I could do that.
Right.
For a little while, I got to kind of doing it through manipulation, sort of, but not for self-gain. You know, I was trying to manipulate people into their own gain. But anyways, so what ended up happening was, it's like what Lewis says, is you don't, I'm going to butcher the quote, but you don't know how truly hard or impossible it is to be a good person until you sincerely tried to.
Yeah.
And that's what I did. That was actually my experience, was I tried to be the best person possible for my wife and kids, to give them what they needed and to help them through everything. And I failed miserably. I caused a lot of damage, actually. Oh. Well, I can't really fairly say how much damage, but I caused a lot of damage in our relationship.
Right.
And so whenever I'm going through all these studies, right. I'm also, so I get to the point where I'm starting to think that the Bible's true, at least through symbology, like how Jonathan Pageot says the Bible reveals the pattern of reality. And I could see that. I started understanding that. And of course, as far as reading the Old Testament, I brought my history lessons into that, you know. Is like the bad people in the Old Testament are me.
Yeah.
And so I'm seeing this in the Old Testament. I see this revealing of pattern of humanity, of how human beings are, because I've studied all this history throughout my life. And through the symbolism, like what Jonathan Pageot presents, I see at least one truth, one absolute truth in the Bible, and it being a revelation, a revealing of the pattern of reality. And I've always had these somewhat spiritual experiences, and so I'm reading the Bible, and I decided, well, if I'm going to depend on the Bible as true, how do I know the Bible I've received is reliable? So I study the history of the texts, how to, you know, especially the New Testament, you know, how do we know, how do we have a reliable copy of the New Testament, or how do we have a reliable copy of the Old Testament? How does the text pass down, you know? And I get a satisfactory answer to that. I find that's reasonably reliable. And, you know, of course, I'm not looking for something as impossible as Cartesian certainty in anything. I'm looking for probable. So anyways, I'm going through all the studies, right? And nothing I'm finding a lot of truth, okay? Mm-hmm. So I keep pursuing truth nuggets, so we'll say. I keep going down this trail of truth nuggets. I feel like there's another truth up ahead, and there's another truth up ahead. I'm doing this intellectual study and journey, and I'm studying the Bible. And you asked if I started this by myself or my family was doing it. I started by myself. And then I realized, see, my wife and I both went to church as a kid. Mm-hmm. I barely did, but she went more. Her grandpa was a Roman Catholic, and she went more with him. And it was interesting because, like I said, I did my historical study, and you couldn't separate Christianity from Western society. Mm-hmm. I couldn't. What I realized was that the children had zero knowledge of any of the Christian story. You know, you couldn't say who was Moses, and they wouldn't know anything about Moses or Noah or the Ark. You know, they didn't know any of it.
Right.
And you know, they were raised completely secular, so to speak. And so I felt like we were failing the kids in that regard, that they didn't even know these stories at all. I mean, I started taking them to church, not to convert them, but just so that they would hear these things, you know, and have some reference. Mm. And of course, at this time, I'm coming closer to believing myself. And so we're going to church. I'm doing all these other studies, and I'm reading the Bible. So I'm starting to be convinced that the Bible's true in these several different ways, that Christianity, you know, I study the historical existence of Jesus, right? Mm-hmm. And despite the small vocal community of mythicists, Jesus's historical existence is pretty well established. But I'm getting all these truth nuggets that I'm pursuing. Mm-hmm. Okay. And I get to this point and I hit a wall. I feel like there's more truth out in front of me, that there's some element of truth that I'm not quite grasping a hold of, but I can't get to it. Cause I'm at this wall, and that's where I get humbled. You know, and it's like, I have to say at that point, you know, I pray. I was like, Lord, I know a few things, you know, I may have this wisdom and knowledge in life and about life or whatever, but you know what, take it and throw it all away, because what I need is your wisdom and knowledge. And when I do that, that's when the spiritual experience of Christianity starts happening. And I start having my own personal spiritual experience of Christianity. And this is when I'm converted. This is when I start knowing more truth that you can't articulate to someone. Mm. You know, Lewis talks about that.
Yeah. And then your family kind of followed afterwards, I assume, or are they still on that journey themselves? Because this was a couple of years ago, right?
Yeah, that was not quite 4 years ago.
Okay.
My wife was most receptive to it. The kids, not so, one of them's baptized out of the four, and mm-hmm. the other one has recently professed faith in Christ. But it's not, I'm giving them this, you know, they got the space to come to their own conclusions, you know. And concerning the idea of indoctrination, we're not in doing that, but what a parent does have to do is they do have to express the truth as they know it to their children,
right? Like, we quote unquote indoctrinate our children to the ideas that, you know, poison is dangerous, don't touch hot stove, eat your three meals a day, don't drive on the wrong side of the road, like, you know, don't do drugs, don't drink and drive. Like, you could say, like, and we do all that to the best of our knowledge, to the best of our ability, you know. Like, if we think something is dangerous, we should, you know, help our kids avoid that thing we think is dangerous or whatever, you know. But like, forcing, you don't, you know, you wouldn't, you know, you don't have to, there are a lot of things you don't have to force a kid to do, you know, yeah. Like, I don't know that the idea of, you know, it's not the case. So it's kind of like this quote from Lewis, I guess, in essence, it's not the case that you, and he's referring to philosophy. So it's not the case that you are going to do no philosophy, right? It's not the case that you're going to have no philosophical beliefs or ideas or whatever. It's rather the case that you're either going to have good ones or bad ones, you know? Yeah. And so it's a little bit like that, like your kids, well, it's not that they're going to learn no beliefs from you, you know, it's whether they're going to learn good or bad ones from you, essentially, yeah. You know.
You have come to, assuming you've come to a truth for yourself, some sort of truth for yourself that you right. base your life on and you live your life on.
Right.
And this could be anything, any sort of wisdom, and you don't pass it on to your children. You're leaving yeah. them at the mercy of everything, the world, so to speak. To learn everything on their own, you know, it's right. like you wouldn't do that with anything. You try to teach them the truth as you know it, and you can go across a line, you know, with yeah. any sort of
oh yeah,
teaching
I would never force anyone to believe anything, you know, like I would never say yeah. believe this or else believe this or you don't get your lunch tomorrow. It's yeah. like I would never do that. Basically, a lot of what people would consider indoctrination is more something born out of necessity. Like you don't have, you yourself go to church and you don't have childcare. So the kids just have to come along because who else is going to watch them, you know?
Yeah.
And it's just sort of something that, you know, and then whenever they, you know, they come to age, like they can choose whether they go or not, you know, like when they can look after themselves, but so long as you, well, you know, that kind of thing. But.
Well, and that's been our approach. When we started going to church, the oldest two, and there's a pretty big gap between the oldest two and the youngest two as far as ages. Mm-hmm. The oldest two are real close to get like 2 years apart, and the youngest two are like a year and a half apart. Mm-hmm. And then there's like 4 or 6 years, I can't remember offhand, that's in between that group, those two groups. Well, the oldest two were pretty much of that age by the time we even started going to church. So there was still an element of, you may be older when you can stay home by yourself, but you're going to come to church some because
right.
they hadn't been yeah. going at all. But fairly quickly, there was that thing. It was like, I would like for you to come to church, but if mm-hmm. you choose not to, then okay.
Yeah.
But the youngest two have to, you know, they're still younger enough. In my opinion, they're still young enough that they go to church. That's just what we do. I don't, you know, they don't have to believe anything. They do have to go because of their age, in my opinion. Mm. And my arbitrary, admittedly, setting for that is like 12, you know, I think around the age of 12, they can start making that decision and have full leeway on it. Do you want to continue going to church or not? That's fine. I would like for you to, you know, yeah. but,
at 12 or 13 is when I stopped going to church. So,
yeah, me too.
Yeah. So I don't know what the right age is for a kid to make the decision, whether they go or don't go. Like I know I was thinking about things, you know, before then, like what I started to think about my own death by the time I was 8 years old. I remember distinctly having those thoughts and fears like of dying at 8 years old, you know? And so like by the time I was 13, it was sort of like, it was something I didn't believe in. It was a nuisance to me most of all, you know? And so it was like, but yeah, you know, and that seems to be a shared, what do you say? Like something shared across a lot of like people's stories that I hear. 13, you know, it was, and then like between 13 and 20 is when people typically stop going to church, I guess.
Yeah.
And then most just don't return. But yeah, I guess we kind of, I mean, we've been talking for a little over an hour now. So I think we were able to cover a lot of good ground. Do you have any closing thoughts or anything you wanted to get to?
Don't be scared of questions, but pursue answers. I think that there are answers out there. I think truth is a thing. And I am convinced of the truth of Christianity. As far as my kids go, we were just talking about, invite questions. They can have all the questions they want. I've had some of the most amazing existential metaphysical questions from a 7-year-old.
Yeah. Oh yeah, of course. Yeah. Do you have a place where people could find you if they want to look you up?
Yeah, you can look me up on Twitter, Ronald D. Potts, or just do that on social media. You'll probably find me. I use my name, my name on everywhere. Okay. I'm gonna kick off a YouTube channel, hopefully, and I'm gonna call it Reverend Ron's Revelation Room.
a lot of alliteration there.
Yeah, three is a little better, but I went with four.
Awesome. Well, looking forward to it then.
Yep. All right. Thank you for having me.
Yeah, thank you. Thanks for taking the time to watch this episode of Will Work for Purpose. If you found anything here interesting, you can always leave a comment below or email me at mosley@tweakingo.com. If you were watching this podcast on YouTube, you can find audio versions of it on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, Stitcher, Google Podcasts, and anywhere else major podcasts are found. So thanks for watching, and we'll see you in the next one.